Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pertinax, the Son of a Slave Who Became Roman Emperor, by Simon Elliott. Narrated by Christopher Ashman. Publisher's Note. This audiobook contains references to material present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. Publius Helvius Pertinax was the emperor who proved that no matter how lowly your birth, within the Roman Empire, you could rise to the very top through hard work, grit, and determination. In his case, he also did it by endeavoring to be a good role model, styling himself on his sometime benefactor Marcus Aurelius. He was also highly thought of by contemporaries, the Greek historian Cassius Dio calling him an excellent and upright man, and Herodians saying he was famous for his accomplishments, both civil and military. He had won many victories over the Germans and the Eastern barbarians. Modern commentators are equally flattering, with Burley saying he was one of the most remarkable figures of any age of Roman history. In short, given that he was the son of a manumitted slave and only joined the cursus honorum, the aristocratic career path, later in life, his story is unique among the lengthy list of Roman emperors. Because of the trajectory of Pertinax's career through Roman society from low to high, this everyman also presents us with a unique prism through which to view the multifarious nature of the Principate Roman Empire at its height in the later 2nd century AD. To that end, this is not just a biography of the man himself, but also the story of the dramatic times in which he lived. Pertinax was born on the 1st of August in AD 126. He was initially a grammarian, or teacher. He then chose a career in the army in his mid-30s, a very late age for such a switch, with the support of a senior family patron. This launched him on a highly unusual and successful journey along the cursus honorum. Initially made an equestrian, he was later adlected into the Senate, meaning he was able to skip the early qualifications necessary for this. He made his name fighting as a cavalry officer in the Roman-Parthian War in the East from 161 to 166. He then had his first taste of life in the troublesome province of Britannia, serving as a military tribune, senior officer, in Legio VI Victrix, based in York, and then as the commander of an auxiliary unit, either one or two Tungrorum. In both roles, he served along Hadrian's Wall, then recently restored as the northern frontier in Britain after the abandonment of the Antonine Wall, and campaigned north into Scotland. This set a pattern for him being an imperial troubleshooter, always serving in provinces where serious action was guaranteed. He was next appointed to take charge of a squadron in Moesia Superior or Inferior, either of cavalry or as a navarcus in the Classis Flavia Moesica, the regional fleet on the Lower Danube. He then served in a procuratorial civilian post in Italy, before returning west as the Praefectus Classis, or Admiral of the Classis Germanica, on the River Rhine. Heading back east again, he was next the procurator of the province of Dacia, the militarized redoubt standing proud of the Danube, during the early stages of the Marco-Manic Wars of Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus. It was then, through the influence of another patron, that he was able to secure more imperial favour here, though at some stage he fell foul of court intrigue and was recalled to Rome. Pertinax was soon back in action on the Danube again, given his value as a military leader, before a major promotion as suffect consul in Rome. This was an appointment to the most senior magisterial position in the imperial capital. The term suffect meaning that he was appointed to complete the consular year of an officeholder who had stepped down. Having filled this role, he was then eligible to become a provincial governor, serving as such in the key frontier provinces of Moesia Inferior and Superior on the Danube, in Dacia again, in Syria where he fought the Parthian Empire once more, in Britain, and finally in Africa Proconsularis as proconsul. In Britain, he overstepped the line as a hard disciplinarian, trying to tackle the mutinous state of the three British legions, who may have tried to elevate him to emperor. These legions were always difficult to manage given their distance from Rome and their permanent service in the never-conquered far north of the province. His refusal to usurp provoked a revolt, with the troops of one legion ambushing him and his Singularis Consularis bodyguard cavalry. The guards were killed and Pertinax left for dead. When recovered, he punished the perpetrators very harshly, perhaps with a decimation. His actions seem to have alienated him from the military establishment in Britain, as he apparently asked to be recalled to Rome because the legions had grown hostile to him. Now an expert in traversing the ups and downs of senatorial life, he was soon back in imperial favour, and by 192 was a full consul for the second time. On this occasion, partnered with the Emperor Commodus. Pertinax had already proved himself adept at managing this unstable emperor, with Herodians saying he was the only survivor of the revered advisers appointed for Commodus by his father. Contemporaries believed that this was either because of his noble nature or because his very humble beginnings meant that he was far less wealthy than any of his senatorial contemporaries, and so was rarely seen as a threat to his rivals. Pertinax's position as consul put him in the best, or as it turned out, worst, of situations. While he was serving in this post, Commodus was assassinated on New Year's Eve, 192-193. The Praetorian prefect and court chamberlain then alighted on Pertinax, perhaps with his foreknowledge, to become emperor. They hoped he would set right the many wrongs of Commodus, and this he did. However, in so doing, he angered the disgruntled Praetorian Guard, who had enjoyed huge freedom to misbehave under the mad and bad Commodus. They soon confronted him, though he survived two usurpation attempts before they finally assassinated him, 86 days after he had become emperor. This event triggered the chaos of the Year of Five Emperors that saw his former mentoree Septimius Severus, the ultimate victor and founder of the Severan dynasty. I have used the widest possible range of data in the research for this book. This includes my own academic research over the last 15 years through my MA in War Studies from King's College London, MA in Archaeology from University College London, and PhD in Archaeology from the University of Kent. Additionally, my recently published works on Roman themes have proved a fertile source of new information regarding the empire in the mid and later 2nd century AD. These include Sea Eagles of Empire, the Classis Britannica and the Battles for Britain, Empire State, How the Roman Military Built an Empire, Septimius Severus in Scotland, the Northern Campaigns of the First Hammer of the Scots, and Roman Legionaries. Meanwhile, specific sources of further information on Pertinax and his times have included the archaeological record, the historical record, using wherever possible key primary sources, and contemporary itineraries and epigraphy, particularly the Brule inscription detailed in Chapter 4, analogy, and where appropriate, anecdote. Much new archaeological information has emerged in recent years concerning the many provinces of the empire and the theatres of war in which Pertinax served. This data is heavily used here. Next, with regard to primary written sources, we have specific accounts of the life of Pertinax from two identified historians. These are Cassius Dio with his Roman History and Herodian with his History of the Roman Empire. The former covers the whole of Roman history in 80 books from the earliest times to his own day, while the latter covers the late 2nd century AD to the mid 3rd century. Both were originally written in Greek and are flawed in their own ways, with the detail often patchy and inaccurate. Dio was born in Nicaea, Bithynia, in 155, and was a direct contemporary of Pertinax. An active senator in public service under Commodus, he was later twice consul, a proconsul, and a governor. While serving in the last position in Pannonia Superior in 226-8, he experienced frontline military action, and this is reflected in his often detailed accounts of such operations in his work. One issue with Dio here is that his writing only survives in excerpts when it deals with the key parts relevant to this narrative, principally within an epitome that was prepared by the 12th century Byzantine historian and monk John Zifilinus. Dio is also clearly a fan of Pertinax, especially after his untimely death, and this needs to be taken into account when using him as a source. Meanwhile, Herodian, an Easterner, was later perhaps a minor public official in Rome. His History of the Roman Empire in his own lifetime came in the form of 8 books, covering the period from the death of Marcus Aurelius in 180 through to the start of Gordian III's reign in 238. This was just after the beginning of the crisis of the 3rd century that permanently changed the nature of the Roman Empire. His principal focus relevant to this work is on Pertinax's accession to the imperial throne and subsequent demise. Herodian was a boy when Pertinax became emperor, and it is highly likely he used Dio as one of his own sources. In that respect, it is no surprise that he is also supportive of Pertinax. Note also needs to be taken that Herodian is often thought highly unreliable and rhetorical, with, for example, Burley, 1999-172, saying that his account of the reign of Septimius Severus is riddled with mistakes, omissions, and inaccuracies. Next, we can add the now anonymous Historia Augusta, a collection of biographies of Roman emperors, junior colleagues, designated heirs and usurpers from the accession of Hadrian in 117 to the elevation of Diocletian in 284. Written towards the end of the 4th century in Latin, modern scholars believe it was based on a single work dating to the period of Dio and Herodian. The leading 20th century historian and classicist, Sir Ronald Syme, believed the author to be an individual he dubbed Ignotus, while others favor a lost work by the historian and senator Marius Maximus, at least for part of it. The Historia Augusta is also thought unreliable and frequently reads as though the author is more interested in entertaining his audience than reporting historical fact. Pausch, 2009-115. To the Historia Augusta, we can also add the works of the later Latin chroniclers Flavius Eutropius, Aurelius Victor, and Paulus Orosius. The first two, and given their use as sources by the third, that too by default, likely used as a major source the so-called Kaisergeschichte, a hypothetical set of short histories now lost. Burgess, 1993-491, argues this was written between 337 and 340. Again, these sources should be considered with care, especially given the length of time between the events they describe and the date when they were written. No modern literary source exists in English regarding Pertinax alone. My narrative is the first to tackle this enigmatic subject. However, given that the life of Pertinax allows us to view the mid and late 2nd century AD in such detail, many other key works are available to illuminate his Icarus-like story. For a broad view of the Roman world at this time, modern works abound. High-quality examples including Mikhail Kulikowski's recent Imperial Triumph, The Roman World from Hadrian to Constantine. The various works of Anthony R. Burley are also most useful, particularly when they touch on Pertinax in the context of his mentoree, the later Emperor Septimius Severus. On specific subjects which feature prominently in this work, David Potter's Rome in the Ancient World is particularly valuable when considering how a Roman emperor ran his empire, while the many works on the Roman military of Adrian Goldsworthy, Ross Cowan, and others provide all the detail needed to consider this very important aspect of the life of Pertinax and his contemporaries. Meanwhile, Guy de la Bédoyère's recent Praetorian illuminates that most Roman of elite military institutions, the Guard, which first elevated Pertinax to the purple, and then proved his nemesis. Slavery in the Roman Empire, the practice of manumission, and the possible careers of freed men are particularly important at the beginning of this story, with key sources being Keith Bradley's Slavery and Society at Rome, Henrik Mauritsen's The Freedman in the Roman World, and Elizabeth Herman Otto's Slaves and Freedmen in the Cambridge Companion to Ancient Rome. On the subject of Roman patronage, so important to Pertinax's elevation into the military and his later political career, Patronage in the Ancient World, edited by Andrew Wallace Hadrill, has proved very useful. Meanwhile, as mentioned earlier, Pertinax was a teacher for much of his early life. This aspect of Roman society is well detailed in works such as Stanley Bonner's Education in Ancient Rome. The Rome Pertinax rose to dominate in his later life is well described in the Cambridge Companion to Ancient Rome, edited by Paul Erdkamp. Meanwhile, Tim Cornell and John Matthews's Atlas of the Roman World has provided extensive information regarding the far-flung provinces where Pertinax spent much of his later career. When it comes to the assassination of Commodus, then Pertinax becoming emperor at the beginning of the Year of the Five Emperors in 193, and finally the later elevation of his immediate successor Marcus Severus Didius Julianus, these events are well detailed in multiple sources. However, Alan Applebaum's Another Look at the Assassination of Pertinax and the Accession of Julianus has provided a new narrative that is considered here. To conclude the review of written sources used in this book, contemporary or later itineraries, such as the Tabula Peutingeriana, Antonine Itinerary, Ravenna Cosmography, and Notitia Dignitatum, and a wide variety of differing types of epigraphy on contemporary stone-built structures and funerary monuments have also proved most useful. Where the data have in any way proved either contradictory or ambiguous, which is often the case with the primary sources, I have endeavoured to use common sense to make a personal judgment on what I believe to be the truth. Moving on to some housekeeping issues, with regard to the use of classical and modern names, I have used the modern name where a place is first mentioned, but also giving its Roman name at that first point of use. When a classical name for a role, position, or event is well understood, I use that, giving the modern name or term at the first use. When emperors are first introduced in the main narrative, I have listed the dates of their reigns. Since much of Pertinax's story was played out across the distant frontiers of the empire, military installations have a key role. I have used the current size-based hierarchy as a means of describing these as they occur in the narrative. Starting with the largest, these are 20 hectare plus legionary fortresses for one or more legions, then 12 hectare plus vexillation fortresses holding a mixed force of legionary cohorts and auxiliaries, next 1 hectare plus forts for outpost garrisons, and finally fortlets for part of an auxiliary unit. A military settlement associated with a fortification is called a canabae when connected with a legionary fortress, and a vicus elsewhere. The built environment again features heavily in the story of Pertinax, as he travelled far and wide throughout the empire in imperial service. Larger towns are categorised as one of three types. These are coloniae, chartered towns for military veterans, in Britain Colchester, Gloucester and Lincoln, for example, municipii, chartered towns of mercantile origin, for example, St. Albans, and Civitates Capitalis. These last, the Roman equivalent of county towns, accommodating the local government of a region. In Britain, Caerwent, Silchester, and Canterbury, for example. Settlements below this level may be small towns, defined as a variety of diverse settlements which often had an association with a specific activity, such as administration, industry, or religion. Villa estates or non-villa estates. Given Pertinax's most humble of origins and then mighty rise to become emperor, an understanding of the social structure of Roman society is also very useful. At the very top of the ranks within the aristocracy was the senatorial class, said to be endowed with wealth, high birth, and moral excellence, and into which Pertinax was adlected, as explained earlier. There were around 600 senators in the mid-second century AD. Those of this class were patricians, a social as well as political rank. All those below, including other aristocrats, were plebeians. Next was the equestrian class, of which Pertinax became a member once he entered the military, having slightly less wealth, but usually with a reputable lineage. They numbered some 30,000 across the empire in the mid-second century AD. Finally, in terms of the aristocracy, there was the curial class, with the bar set slightly lower again. These were usually merchants and mid-level landowners, making up a large percentage of the town councillors in the Principate Empire. Below this were freemen who were free in the sense that they had never been slaves, Pertinax starting his adult life with this status. Freemen included the majority of smaller-scale merchants, artisans, and professionals in Roman society. All of the above classes were also full cives Romani, citizens of the Roman Empire, if they came from Italy. They enjoyed the widest range of protections and privileges as defined by the Roman state, and could travel the breadth of the empire pursuing their professional ambitions, as seen with Pertinax. Roman women had a limited type of citizenship and were not allowed to vote or stand for public or civil office. Freemen born outside of Italy in the imperial provinces were called peregrini, meaning in Latin, one from abroad, until Caracalla's 212 Constitutio Antoniniana, an edict that made all freemen of the empire into citizens. In the 1st and 2nd centuries AD, peregrini made up the vast majority of the empire's inhabitants. Further down the social ladder were freedmen, former slaves who had been manumitted by their masters. Once free, these former slaves often remained with the wider family of their pater familias, head of family, former owner, frequently taking that person's name in some way. Providing the correct process of manumission was followed, freedmen could become citizens, peregrini, though with fewer civic rights than a freeman, including not being able to stand for the majority of public offices. Their children were freemen, as with Pertinax. Many freedmen became highly successful, and since they were not allowed to stand for public office, found other ways to celebrate their lives. A common choice was the creation of monumentalized funerary memorials, a well-known example being that of the baker Marcus Virgilius Eurysaces in Rome. Meanwhile, at the bottom of society were slaves. Roman slavery is covered in detail in Chapter 1. The story of Pertinax takes place in the Principate phase of the Roman Empire's existence, this dating from 27 BC, when Augustus was first acknowledged as emperor by the Senate, until AD 284, when the accession of Diocletian brought about the end of the crisis of the 3rd century. The name is derived from the term princeps, chief or master, referring to the emperor as the leading citizen of the empire. While princeps was not an official title, emperors often assumed it on their accession, it clearly being a conceit allowing the empire to be explained away as a simple continuance of the preceding republic. Because of the major structural changes to the nature of the Roman Empire as it exited the crisis of the 3rd century, the period that followed until the end of the Western Empire in 476 is called the Dominate. This was a new, far more overtly imperial system, the title based on the word dominus, or lord, the emperor now being effectively the equivalent of an eastern potentate. Next, a note on terminology. In this work, the words German and Goth are frequently used. Both are problematic in that they infer a tribal identity that in reality did not exist. While each grouping may have often shared the same blood and cultural practices, the tribes more commonly fought among themselves than against the Romans, and indeed later in the empire provided many of the troops and military leaders in the dominate Roman army. Even the term tribe is itself problematic, given that many were confederations of various regional groupings. While acknowledging these issues, I retain the use of the words here for ease of reference. Pertinax's career path governing some of the key provinces of the Roman Empire is a core feature of this work. The word itself provides interesting insight into the Roman attitude to its empire. The Latin provincia, meaning land for conquering. Maitzak 2009-60. There were actually two kinds of province in the Principate Roman Empire. These were senatorial provinces left to the Senate to administer, whose governors were officially called proconsuls and remained in post for a year, and imperial provinces retained under the supervision of the emperor. The emperor personally chose the governors for these, they often being styled legati augusti proprietor to mark them out officially as deputies of the emperor. Senatorial provinces tended to be those deep within the empire, where less trouble was expected. At the beginning of the 1st century AD, these were Baetica, in southern Spain, Narbonensis, in southern France, Corsica et Sardinia, Africa Proconsularis, in North Africa, Cyrenaica et Creta, North Africa and Crete, Epirus, in modern Albania and Greece, Macedonia, Achaia, in Greece's Peloponnese, Asia, in western Anatolia, Bithynia et Pontus, on Turkey's Black Sea coast. In this work, I will specifically use proconsul to refer to the governor of these senatorial provinces, and governor to refer to this position in an imperial province. In that context, Pertinax would have been proconsul when governing Africa Proconsularis, and governor when the emperor's representative elsewhere. As far as the chapter flow of this book is concerned, after this introduction, chapter 1 introduces the listener to our protagonist Pertinax. Here his early life is considered, including his birth in northeastern Italy, his family, including father Helvius Successus, a manumitted former slave, the family business in the timber or wool trade, his education, and finally his early career as a grammarian/teacher. The chapter also considers the three Roman institutions that played such an important role in the family's story, these being slavery, the process of manumission, and patronage. Chapters 2 and 3 provide detail of various aspects of the Roman Empire at the time of Pertinax to give context to his later life. The first provides a brief history of the Principate Empire to the time of Pertinax, then an extensive overview of its various provinces, given that his story covers the empire's wide breadth, and finally details the Principate system of government to enable readers to understand first how Pertinax came to power, and then how he ran the empire during his short time in office. Chapter 3 looks at the Roman military establishment in the mid to late 2nd century AD, and separately at the Praetorian Guard, so important as the story of Pertinax later concludes. Chapter 4 tracks Pertinax's military career after he changed paths so late in life. This includes the role of the family patron, Lollianus Avitus, Pertinax's appointment, and service as a prefect or junior officer in a Syrian-based auxiliary cavalry unit, and his role in the sanguinary 161-5 Roman-Parthian War. The chapter then moves on to his next military appointment, to the farthest-flung legionary fortress in the Roman Empire at York, as a military tribune with Legio VI Victrix, and later as commander of an auxiliary unit on Hadrian's Wall. Pertinax's activities on Rome's most northerly border will here be considered in detail. Chapter 5 then covers his service in Moesia, commanding cavalry again, or as a squadron commander with the Classis Flavia Moesica, the Lower Danube regional fleet, followed by a short civilian posting. The chapter then details his dramatic rise to full fleet admiral in charge of the Classis Germanica Rhine fleet. His service in Dacia as procurator follows, then his return to military action on the Danube, his appointment as suffect consul in Rome, and after that his promotion to become the troubleshooting governor sequentially of Moesia Inferior, Moesia Superior, Dacia, the last two at the same time, and Syria. In the Syrian post he fought the Parthian Empire once more, and for the first time met Septimius Severus, who was the legionary legate of Legio IV Civica. The chapter closes by reviewing his troubled time as governor in Britain, where he was almost assassinated by a legion, and finally his posting as proconsul in Africa Proconsularis. Chapter 6 covers Pertinax's final ascent to the imperial throne. Having asked to return to Rome from Britain, he was soon progressing along the cursus honorum once more, ultimately becoming co-consul with the emperor in 192. The assassination of Commodus, Pertinax...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?